Chapter 13. Either or. The few words which Marguerite Blakeney had managed to read on the half-scorched piece of paper seemed literally to be the words of fate. Start myself tomorrow. This she had read quite distinctly. Then came a blur caused by the smoke of the candle, which obliterated the next few words, but right at the bottom there was another sentence which was now standing clearly and distinctly like letters of fire before her mental vision. If you wish to speak to me again, I shall be in the supper-room at 1 o'clock precisely. The whole was signed with the hastily scrawled little device, a tiny star-shaped flower which had become so familiar to her.
1 o'clock precisely. It was now close upon 11. The last minuet was being danced, with Sir Andrew Ffoulkes and the beautiful Lady Blakeney leading the couples through its delicate and intricate figures. Close upon 11. The hands of the handsome Louis XV clock upon its ormolu bracket seemed to move along with maddening rapidity. 2 hours more, and her fate and that of Armand would be sealed. In 2 hours she must make up her mind whether she will keep the knowledge so cunningly gained to herself and leave her brother to his fate, or whether she will wilfully betray a brave man whose life was devoted to his fellow men, who was noble, generous, and above all unsuspecting. It seemed a horrible thing to do. But then there was Armand. Armand, too, was noble and brave. Armand, too, was unsuspecting. And Armand loved her, would have willingly trusted his life in her hands, and now, when she could save him from death, she hesitated. Oh, it was monstrous. Her brother's kind, gentle face, so full of love for her, seemed to be looking reproachfully at her. "You might have saved me, Margot," he seemed to say to her.
"And you chose the life of a stranger, a man you do not know, whom you have never seen, and preferred that he should be safe, whilst you sent me to the guillotine."
All these conflicting thoughts raged through Marguerite's brain, while, with a smile upon her lips, she glided through the graceful mazes of the minuet. She noted, with that acute sense of hers, that she had succeeded in completely allaying Sir Andrew's fears. Her self-control had been absolutely perfect. She was a finer actress at this moment, and throughout the whole of this minuet, than she had ever been upon the boards of the Comédie Française. But then, a beloved brother's life had not depended upon her histrionic powers. She was too clever to overdo her part, and made no further allusions to the supposed billet doux which had caused Sir Andrew Ffoulkes such an agonizing 5 minutes. She watched his anxiety melting away under her sunny smile, and soon perceived that, whatever doubt may have crossed his mind at the moment, she had, by the time the last bars of the minuet had been played, succeeded in completely dispelling it. He never realized in what a fever of excitement she was, what effort it cost her to keep up a constant ripple of banal conversation. When the minuet was over, she asked Sir Andrew to take her into the next room. "I have promised to go down to supper with His Royal Highness," she said. "But before we part, tell me, am I forgiven?"
"Forgiven?"
"Yes. Confess, I gave you a fright just now. But remember, I am not an Englishwoman, and I do not look upon the exchanging of billets doux as a crime, and I vow I'll not tell my little Suzanne. But now, tell me, shall I welcome you at my water party on Wednesday?"
"I am not sure, Lady Blakeney," he replied evasively. "I may have to leave London tomorrow."
"I would not do that if I were you," she said earnestly. Then, seeing the anxious look once more reappearing in his eyes, she added gaily, "No one can throw a ball better than you can, Sir Andrew. We should so miss you on the bowling green."
He had led her across the room to one beyond, where already His Royal Highness was waiting for the beautiful Lady Blakeney.
"Madame, supper awaits us," said the Prince, offering his arm to Marguerite, "and I am full of hope. The goddess Fortune has frowned so persistently on me at hazard that I look with confidence for the smiles of the goddess of beauty."
"Your Highness has been unfortunate at the card-tables?" asked Marguerite, as she took the Prince's arm.
"Aye, most unfortunate. Blakeney, not content with being the richest among my father's subjects, has also the most outrageous luck. By the way, where is that inimitable wit? I vow, madam, that this life would be but a dreary desert without your smiles and his sallies."
Chapter 14. 1 o'clock precisely.
Supper had been extremely gay. All those present declared that never had Lady Blakeney been more adorable, nor that demmed idiot Sir Percy more amusing. His Royal Highness had laughed until the tears streamed down his cheeks at Blakeney's foolish yet funny repartees. His doggerel verse, "We seek him here, we seek him there," was sung to the tune of "Ho, Merry Britons," and to the accompaniment of glasses knocked loudly against the table. Lord Grenville, moreover, had a most perfect cook. Some wags asserted that he was a scion of the old French noblesse, who, having lost his fortune, had come to seek it in the cuisine of the Foreign Office. Marguerite Blakeney was in her most brilliant mood, and surely not a soul in that crowded supper-room had even an inkling of the terrible struggle which was raging within her heart. The clock was ticking so mercilessly on. It was midnight, and even the Prince of Wales was thinking of leaving the supper-table. Within the next half-hour, the destinies of two brave men would be pitted against one another, the dearly beloved brother and he, the unknown hero. Marguerite had not even tried to see Chauvelin during this last hour. She knew that his keen, fox-like eyes would terrify her at once, and incline the balance of her decision towards Armand. Whilst she did not see him, there still lingered in her heart of hearts a vague, undefined hope that something would occur, something big, enormous, epoch-making, which would shift from her young, weak shoulders this terrible burden of responsibility, of having to choose between two such cruel alternatives. But the minutes ticked on with that dull monotony which they invariably seem to assume when our very nerves ache with their incessant ticking. After supper, dancing was resumed. His Royal Highness had left, and there was general talk of departing among the older guests. The young ones were indefatigable, and had started on a new gavotte, which would fill the next quarter of an hour. Marguerite did not feel equal to another dance. There is a limit to the most enduring self-control. Escorted by a cabinet minister, she had once more found her way to the tiny boudoir, still the most deserted among all the rooms. She knew that Chauvelin must be lying in wait for her somewhere, ready to seize the first possible opportunity for a tête-à-tête. His eyes had met hers for a moment after the four-supper minuet, and she knew that the keen diplomatist, with those searching pale eyes of his, had divined that her work was accomplished. Fate had willed it so. Marguerite, torn by the most terrible conflict heart of woman can ever know, had resigned herself to its decrees. But Armand must be saved at any cost. He, first of all, for he was her brother, had been mother, father, friend to her ever since she, a tiny babe, had lost both her parents. To think of Armand dying a traitor's death on the guillotine was too horrible even to dwell upon. Impossible, in fact. That could never be. Never. As for the stranger, the hero, well, there, let fate decide. Marguerite would redeem her brother's life at the hands of the relentless enemy, then let that cunning Scarlet Pimpernel extricate himself after that. Perhaps, vaguely, Marguerite hoped that the daring plotter, who for so many months had baffled an army of spies, would still manage to evade Chauvelin and remain immune to the end. She thought of all this as she sat listening to the witty discourse of the cabinet minister, who, no doubt, felt that he had found in Lady Blakeney a most perfect listener. Suddenly, she saw the keen, fox-like face of Chauvelin peeping through the curtained doorway.
"Lord Fancourt," she said to the minister, "will you do me a service?"
"I am entirely at your ladyship's service," he replied gallantly.
"Will you see if my husband is still in the card-room? And if he is, will you tell him that I am very tired and would be glad to go home soon?"
The commands of a beautiful woman are binding on all mankind, even on cabinet ministers.
Lord Fancourt prepared to obey instantly.
"I do not like to leave your ladyship alone," he said.
"Oh, never fear. I shall be quite safe here, and, I think, undisturbed. But I am really tired. You know Sir Percy will drive back to Richmond. It is a long way, and we shall not, and we do not hurry, get home before daybreak."
Lord Fancourt had perforce to go. The moment he had disappeared, Chauvelin slipped into the room, and the next instant stood calm and impassive by her side. "You have news for me?" he said. An icy mantle seemed to have suddenly settled round Marguerite's shoulders. Though her cheeks glowed with fire, she felt chilled and numbed. "Oh, Armand, will you ever know the terrible sacrifice of pride, of dignity, of womanliness a devoted sister is making for your sake?"
"Nothing of importance," she said, staring mechanically before her. "But it might prove a clue. I contrived, no matter how, to detect Sir Andrew Ffoulkes in the very act of burning a paper at one of these candles in this very room. That paper I succeeded in holding between my fingers for the space of 2 minutes, and to cast my eye on it for that of 10 seconds.
"Time enough to learn its contents?" asked Chauvelin quietly. She nodded. Then she continued in the same even, mechanical tone of voice.
"In the corner of the paper there was the usual rough device of a small star-shaped flower. Above it I read 2 lines. Everything else was scorched and blackened by the flame."
"And what were these 2 lines?"
Her throat seemed suddenly to have contracted. For an instant she felt that she could not speak the words which might send a brave man to his death.
"It is lucky that the whole paper was not burned," added Chauvelin with dry sarcasm, "for it might have fared ill with Armand Saint-Just. What were the 2 lines, citoyenne?"
"One was, 'I start myself tomorrow,'" she said quietly. "The other, 'If you wish to speak to me, I shall be in the supper-room at 1 o'clock precisely.'"
Chauvelin looked up at the clock just above the mantelpiece. "Then I have plenty of time," he said placidly.
"What are you going to do?" she asked.
She was pale as a statue. Her hands were icy cold. Her head and heart throbbed with the awful strain upon her nerves. Oh, this was cruel, cruel. What had she done to have deserved all this? Her choice was made. Had she done a vile action or one that was sublime? The recording angel who writes in the Book of Gold alone could give an answer.
"What are you going to do?" she repeated mechanically.
"Oh, nothing for the present. After that it will depend."
"On what?"
"On whom I shall see in the supper-room at 1 o'clock precisely."
"You will see the Scarlet Pimpernel, of course. But you do not know him."
"No, but I shall presently."
"Sir Andrew will have warned him."
"I think not. When you parted from him after the minuet, he stood and watched you for a moment or two, with a look which gave me to understand that something had happened between you. It was only natural, was it not, that I should make a shrewd guess as to the nature of that something. I thereupon engaged the young gallant in a long and animated conversation. We discussed Herr Gluck's singular success in London, until a lady claimed his arm for supper."
"Since then?"
"I did not lose sight of him through supper. When we all came upstairs again, Lady Portals buttonholed him and started on the subject of pretty Mademoiselle Suzanne de Tournay. I knew he would not move until Lady Portals had exhausted the subject, which will not be for another quarter of an hour at least, and it is 1:05 now." He was preparing to go, and went up to the doorway where, drawing aside the curtain, he stood for a moment pointing out to Marguerite the distant figure of Sir Andrew Ffoulkes in close conversation with Lady Portals. "I think," he said with a triumphant smile, "that I may safely expect to find the person I seek in the dining-room, fair lady."
"There may be more than one."
"Whoever is there as the clock strikes one will be shadowed by one of my men. Of these, one, or perhaps two, or even three, will leave for France tomorrow. One of these will be the Scarlet Pimpernel."
"Yes, and?"
"I also, fair lady, will leave for France tomorrow."
"The papers found at Dover upon the person of Sir Andrew Ffoulkes speak of the neighbourhood of Calais, of an inn which I know well called Le Chargris, of a lonely place somewhere on the coast, the Père Blanchard's hut, which I must endeavour to find. All these places are given as the point where this meddlesome Englishman has bidden the traitor de Tournay and others to meet his emissaries. But it seems that he has decided not to send his emissaries, that he will start himself tomorrow. Now, one of those persons whom I shall see anon in the supper-room will be journeying to Calais, and I shall follow that person until I have tracked him to where those fugitive aristocrats await him. For that person, fair lady, will be the man whom I have sought for nearly a year. the man whose energy has outdone me, whose ingenuity has baffled me, whose audacity has set me wondering. Yes, me, who have seen a trick or two in my time. The mysterious and elusive Scarlet Pimpernel.
And Armand?
She pleaded. Have I ever broken my word? I promise you that the day the Scarlet Pimpernel and I start for France, I will send you that imprudent letter of his by special courier.
More than that, I will pledge you the word of France that the day I lay hands on that meddlesome Englishman, Saint-Just will be here in England, safe in the arms of his charming sister.
And with a deep and elaborate bow and another look at the clock, Chauvelin glided out of the room. It seemed to Marguerite that through all the noise, all the din of music, dancing, and laughter, she could hear his cat-like tread gliding through the vast reception rooms, that she could hear him go down the massive staircase, reach the dining room, and open the door. Fate had decided, had made her speak, had made her do a vile and abominable thing for the sake of the brother she loved. She lay back in her chair, passive and still, seeing the figure of her relentless enemy ever present before her aching eyes. When Chauvelin reached the supper-room, it was quite deserted. It had that woe-begone, forsaken, tawdry appearance which reminds one so much of a ball-dress the morning after. Half-empty glasses littered the table, unfolded napkins lay about, the chairs, turned towards one another in groups of twos and threes, seemed like the seats of ghosts in close conversation with one another.
There were sets of two chairs, very close to one another, in the far corner of the room, which spoke of recent whispered flirtations over cold game pie and champagne. There were sets of three and four chairs that recalled pleasant animated discussions over the latest scandals. There were chairs straight up in a row that still looked starchy, critical, acid, like antiquated dowagers. There were a few isolated, single chairs close to the table that spoke of gourmands intent on the most recherché dishes, and others overturned on the floor that spoke volumes on the subject of my Lord Grenville's cellars.
It was a ghost-like replica, in fact, of that fashionable gathering upstairs, a ghost that haunts every house where balls and good suppers are given. A picture drawn with white chalk on grey cardboard, dull and colourless, now that the bright silk dresses and gorgeously embroidered coats were no longer there to fill in the foreground, and now that the candles flickered sleepily in their sockets. Chauvelin smiled benignly, and rubbing his long, thin hands together, he looked round the deserted supper-room, whence even the last flunky had retired in order to rejoin his friends in the hall below. All was silence in the dimly lighted room, whilst the sound of the gavotte, the hum of distant talk and laughter, and the rumble of an occasional coach outside only seemed to reach this palace of the sleeping beauty as the murmur of some flitting spooks far away. It all looked so peaceful, so luxurious, and so still, that the keenest observer, a veritable prophet, could never have guessed that, at this moment, that deserted supper-room was nothing but a trap, laid for the capture of the most cunning and audacious plotter those stirring times had ever seen. Chauvelin pondered and tried to peer into the immediate future. What would this man be like, whom he and the leaders of a whole revolution had sworn to bring to his death? Everything about him was weird and mysterious. His personality, which he had so cunningly concealed. The power he wielded over 19 English gentlemen who seemed to obey his every command blindly and enthusiastically. The passionate love and submission he had roused in his little trained band. And, above all, his marvellous audacity. The boundless impudence which had caused him to beard his most implacable enemies within the very walls of Paris. No wonder that in France the sobriquet of the mysterious Englishman roused in the people a superstitious shudder. Chauvelin himself, as he gazed round the deserted room, where presently the weird hero would appear, felt a strange feeling of awe creeping all down his spine. But his plans were well laid. He felt sure that the Scarlet Pimpernel had not been warned, and felt equally sure that Marguerite Blakeney had not played him false. If she had, a cruel look that would have made her shudder gleamed in Chauvelin's keen, pale eyes. If she had played him a trick, Armand Saint-Just would suffer the extreme penalty. But no. No. Of course she had not played him false. Fortunately, the supper-room was deserted. This would make Chauvelin's task all the easier, when presently that unsuspecting enigma would enter it alone.
No one was here now save Chauvelin himself.
Stay.
As he surveyed with a satisfied smile the solitude of the room, the cunning agent of the French government became aware of the peaceful, monotonous breathing of some one of my Lord Grenville's guests, who, no doubt, had supped both wisely and well, and was enjoying a quiet sleep away from the din of the dancing above. Chauvelin looked round once more, and there, in the corner of a sofa, in the dark angle of the room, his mouth open, his eyes shut, the sweet sounds of peaceful slumbers proceeding from his nostrils, reclined the gorgeously apparelled, long-limbed husband of the cleverest woman in Europe. Chauvelin looked at him as he lay there, placid, unconscious, at peace with all the world and himself after the best of suppers. And a smile that was almost one of pity softened for a moment the hard lines of the Frenchman's face and the sarcastic twinkle of his pale eyes. Evidently the slumberer, deep in dreamless sleep, would not interfere with Chauvelin's trap for catching that cunning Scarlet Pimpernel. Again he rubbed his hands together, and, following the example of Sir Percy Blakeney, he too stretched himself out in the corner of another sofa, shut his eyes, opened his mouth, gave forth sounds of peaceful breathing, and waited. Chapter 15. Doubt. Marguerite Blakeney had watched the slight, sable-clad figure of Chauvelin as he worked his way through the ballroom. Then, perforce, she had had to wait, while her nerves tingled with excitement. Listlessly she sat in the small, still deserted boudoir, looking out through the curtained doorway on the dancing couples beyond. Looking at them, yet seeing nothing, hearing the music, yet conscious of naught save a feeling of expectancy, of anxious, weary waiting. Her mind conjured up before her the vision of what was, perhaps at this very moment, passing downstairs. The half-deserted dining-room, the fateful hour, Chauvelin on the watch. Then, precise to the moment, the entrance of a man, he, the Scarlet Pimpernel, the mysterious leader who to Marguerite had become almost unreal, so strange, so weird was this hidden identity. She wished she were in the supper-room too, at this moment, watching him as he entered. She knew that her woman's penetration would at once recognize in the stranger's face, whoever he might be, that strong individuality which belongs to a leader of men, to a hero, to the mighty, high-soaring eagle whose daring wings were becoming entangled in the ferret's trap. Womanlike, she thought of him with unmixed sadness. The irony of that fate seemed so cruel which allowed the fearless lion to succumb to the gnawing of a rat. Ah! Had Armand's life not been at stake?
"Faith, your ladyship must have thought me very remiss," said a voice suddenly close to her elbow. "I had a deal of difficulty in delivering your message, for I could not find Blakeney anywhere at first."
Marguerite had forgotten all about her husband and her message to him. His very name, as spoken by Lord Fancourt, sounded strange and unfamiliar to her, so completely had she, in the last 5 minutes, lived her old life in the Rue de Richelieu again, with Armand always near her to love and protect her, to guard her from the many subtle intrigues which were forever raging in Paris in those days.
"I did find him at last," continued Lord Fancourt, "and gave him your message. He said that he would give orders at once for the horses to be put to."
"Ah," she said, still very absently, "you found my husband and gave him my message?"
"Yes. He was in the dining-room, fast asleep. I could not manage to wake him up at first."
"Thank you very much," she said mechanically, trying to collect her thoughts.
"Will your ladyship honour me with the contredanse until your coach is ready?" asked Lord Fancourt.
No, I thank you, my lord. But, and you will forgive me, I really am too tired, and the heat in the ballroom has become oppressive."
"The conservatory is deliciously cool. Let me take you there and then get you something. You seem ailing, Lady Blakeney."
"I am only very tired," she repeated wearily, as she allowed Lord Fancourt to lead her, where subdued lights and green plants lent coolness to the air. He got her a chair, into which she sank. This long interval of waiting was intolerable. Why did not Chauvelin come and tell her the result of his watch? Lord Fancourt was very attentive. She scarcely heard what he said, and suddenly startled him by asking abruptly,
"Lord Fancourt, did you perceive who was in the dining-room just now besides Sir Percy Blakeney?"
"Only the agent of the French government, Monsieur Chauvelin, equally fast asleep in another corner," he said. "Why does your ladyship ask?"
"I know not. Did you notice the time when you were there?"
"It must have been about 5 or 10 minutes past one."
"I wonder what your ladyship is thinking about,"
he added, for evidently the fair lady's thoughts were very far away, and she had not been listening to his intellectual conversation. But indeed her thoughts were not very far away. Only one story below, in this same house, in the dining room where sat Chauvelin still on the watch. Had he failed? For one instant that possibility rose before her as a hope, the hope that the Scarlet Pimpernel had been warned by Sir Andrew, and that Chauvelin's trap had failed to catch his bird. But that hope soon gave way to fear. Had he failed? But then, Armand. Lord Fancourt had given up talking since he found that he had no listener. He wanted an opportunity for slipping away, for sitting opposite to a lady, however fair, who is evidently not heeding the most vigorous efforts made for her entertainment, is not exhilarating, even to a cabinet minister. "Shall I find out if your ladyship's coach is ready?" he said at last, tentatively.
"Oh, thank you. Thank you, if you would be so kind. I fear I am but sorry company. But I am really tired, and perhaps would be best alone."
She had been longing to be rid of him, for she hoped that, like the fox he so resembled, Chauvelin would be prowling round, thinking to find her alone. But Lord Fancourt went, and still Chauvelin did not come. Oh, what had happened? She felt Armand's fate trembling in the balance. She feared, now with a deadly fear, that Chauvelin had failed, and that the mysterious Scarlet Pimpernel had proved elusive once more. Then she knew that she need hope for no pity, no mercy from him. He had pronounced his either-or, and nothing less would content him. He was very spiteful, and would affect the belief that she had wilfully misled him, and having failed to trap the eagle once again, his revengeful mind would be content with the humble prey, Armand. Yet she had done her best, had strained every nerve for Armand's sake. She could not bear to think that all had failed. She could not sit still. She wanted to go and hear the worst at once. She wondered even that Chauvelin had not come yet to vent his wrath and satire upon her. Lord Grenville himself came presently to tell her that her coach was ready, and that Sir Percy was already waiting for her, ribbons in hand. Marguerite said farewell to her distinguished host. Many of her friends stopped her as she crossed the rooms, to talk to her and exchange pleasant au revoirs. The minister only took final leave of beautiful Lady Blakeney on the top of the stairs. Below, on the landing, a veritable army of gallant gentlemen were waiting to bid good-bye to the queen of beauty and fashion, whilst outside, under the massive portico, Sir Percy's magnificent bays were impatiently pawing the ground. At the top of the stairs, just after she had taken final leave of her host, she suddenly saw Chauvelin. He was coming up the stairs slowly, and rubbing his thin hands very softly together. There was a curious look on his mobile face, partly amused and wholly puzzled, and as his keen eyes met Marguerite's they became strangely sarcastic.
"Monsieur Chauvelin," she said,
as he stopped on the top of the stairs, bowing elaborately before her,
"my coach is outside. May I claim your arm?"
As gallant as ever, he offered her his arm and led her downstairs. The crowd was very great. Some of the minister's guests were departing, others were leaning against the banisters watching the throng as it filed up and down the wide staircase.
"Chauvelin," she said at last, desperately, "I must know what has happened."
"What has happened, dear lady?"
he said with affected surprise.
"Where? When?" "You are torturing me, Chauvelin. I have helped you tonight. Surely I have the right to know. What happened in the dining room at 1 o'clock just now?"
She spoke in a whisper, trusting that in the general hubbub of the crowd her words would remain unheeded by all save the man at her side.
"Quiet and peace reign supreme, fair lady. At that hour I was asleep in the corner of one sofa and Sir Percy Blakeney in another."
"Nobody came into the room at all?"
"Nobody."
"Then we have failed, you and I?"
"Yes, we have failed, perhaps."
"But Armand?"
she pleaded.
"Ah, Armand Saint-Just's chances hang on a thread. Pray heaven, dear lady, that thread may not snap."
Chauvelin, I worked for you sincerely, earnestly, remember?'
"'I remember my promise,' he said quietly. "'The day that the Scarlet Pimpernel and I meet on French soil, Saint-Just will be in the arms of his charming sister.'
"'Which means that the brave man's blood will be on my hands,' she said with a shudder.
"'His blood, or that of your brother, surely at the present moment you must hope, as I do, that the enigmatical Scarlet Pimpernel will start for Calais today.
"'I am only conscious of one hope, citoyen.
"'And that is that Satan, your master, will have need of you elsewhere before the sun rises today. "'You flatter me, citoyenne.'
She had detained him for a while midway down the stairs, trying to get at the thoughts which lay beyond that thin, fox-like mask. But Chauvelin remained urbane, sarcastic, mysterious. Not a line betrayed to the poor, anxious woman whether she need fear or whether she dared to hope.
Downstairs on the landing she was soon surrounded. Lady Blakeney never stepped from any house into her coach without an escort of fluttering human moths around the dazzling light of her beauty. But before she finally turned away from Chauvelin, she held out a tiny hand to him, with that pretty gesture of childish appeal which was so essentially her own.
"'Give me some hope, my little Chauvelin,' she pleaded.
With perfect gallantry he bowed over that tiny hand, which looked so dainty and white through the delicately transparent black lace mitten, and kissing the tips of the rosy fingers. "'By heaven that the thread may not snap,' he repeated with his enigmatic smile. And, stepping aside, he allowed the moths to flutter more closely round the candle, and the brilliant throng of the Jeunesse Dorée, eagerly attentive to Lady Blakeney's every movement, hid the keen, fox-like face from her view. Chapter 16. Richmond. A few minutes later she was sitting, wrapped in cosy furs, near Sir Percy Blakeney on the box seat of his magnificent coach, and the four splendid bays had thundered down the quiet street. The night was warm in spite of the gentle breeze which fanned Marguerite's burning cheeks. Soon London houses were left behind, and rattling over old Hammersmith Bridge, Sir Percy was driving his bays rapidly towards Richmond. The river wound in and out in its pretty, delicate curves, looking like a silver serpent beneath the glittering rays of the moon. Long shadows from overhanging trees spread occasional deep pools right across the road. The bays were rushing along at breakneck speed, held but slightly back by Sir Percy's strong, unerring hands. These nightly drives after balls and suppers in London were a source of perpetual delight to Marguerite, and she appreciated her husband's eccentricity keenly, which caused him to adopt this mode of taking her home every night to their beautiful home by the river, instead of living in a stuffy London house. He loved driving his spirited horses along the lonely moonlit roads, and she loved to sit on the box seat with the soft air of an English late summer's night fanning her face after the hot atmosphere of a ball or supper party. The drive was not a long one, less than an hour sometimes, when the bays were very fresh, and Sir Percy gave them full rein. Tonight he seemed to have a very devil in his fingers, and the coach seemed to fly along the road beside the river. As usual, he did not speak to her, but stared straight in front of him, the ribbons seeming to lie quite loosely in his slender white hands. Marguerite looked at him tentatively once or twice. She could see his handsome profile and one lazy eye with its straight, fine brow and drooping, heavy lid. The face in the moonlight looked singularly earnest, and recalled to Marguerite's aching heart those happy days of courtship, before he had become the lazy nincompoop, the effete fop, whose life seemed spent in card and supper-rooms. But now, in the moonlight, she could not catch the expression of the lazy blue eyes. She could only see the outline of the firm chin, the corner of the strong mouth, the well-cut, massive shape of the forehead. Truly, nature had meant well by Sir Percy. His faults must all be laid at the door of that poor, half-crazy mother, and of the distracted, heart-broken father, neither of whom had cared for the young life which was sprouting up between them, and which, perhaps, their very carelessness was already beginning to wreck. Marguerite suddenly felt intense sympathy for her husband. The moral crisis she had just gone through made her feel indulgent towards the faults, the delinquencies of others.
How thoroughly a human being can be buffeted and overmastered by fate had been borne in upon her with appalling force. Had anyone told her a week ago that she would stoop to spy upon her friends, that she would betray a brave and unsuspecting man into the hands of a relentless enemy, she would have laughed the idea to scorn. Yet she had done these things. Anon, perhaps the death of that brave man would be at her door, just as, 2 years ago, the Marquis de Saint-Cyr had perished through a thoughtless word of hers. But in that case she was morally innocent. She had meant no serious harm. Fate merely had stepped in. But this time she had done a thing that obviously was base, had done it deliberately, for a motive which, perhaps, high moralists would not even appreciate. And as she felt her husband's strong arm beside her, she also felt how much more he would dislike and despise her if he knew of this night's work. Thus human beings judge of one another superficially, casually, throwing contempt on one another with but little reason and no charity. She despised her husband for his inanities and vulgar, unintellectual occupations, and he, she felt, would despise her still worse because she had not been strong enough to do right for right's sake, and to sacrifice her brother to the dictates of her conscience. Buried in her thoughts, Marguerite had found this hour in the breezy summer night all too brief, and it was with a feeling of keen disappointment that she suddenly realized that the bays had turned into the massive gates of her beautiful English home. Sir Percy Blakeney's house on the river has become a historic one. Palatial in its dimensions, it stands in the midst of exquisitely laid-out gardens, with a picturesque terrace and frontage to the river. Built in Tudor days, the old red brick of the walls look eminently picturesque in the midst of a bower of green, the beautiful lawn, with its old sundial adding the true note of harmony to its foreground. Great secular trees lent cool shadows to the grounds, and now, on this warm, early autumn night, the leaves slightly turned to russets and gold, the old garden looked singularly poetic and peaceful in the moonlight. With unerring precision, Sir Percy had brought the four bays to a standstill immediately in front of the fine Elizabethan entrance hall. In spite of the lateness of the hour, an army of grooms seemed to have emerged from the very ground as the coach had thundered up and were standing respectfully round. Sir Percy jumped down quickly, then helped Marguerite to alight. She lingered outside for a moment whilst he gave a few orders to one of his men. She skirted the house and stepped onto the lawn, looking out dreamily into the silvery landscape. Nature seemed exquisitely at peace in comparison with the tumultuous emotions she had gone through. She could faintly hear the ripple of the river and the occasional soft and ghost-like fall of a dead leaf from a tree. All else was quiet round her. She had heard the horses prancing as they were being led away to their distant stables, the hurrying of servants' feet as they had all gone within to rest. The house also was quite still. In two separate suites of apartments just above the magnificent reception rooms, lights were still burning. They were her rooms and his, well divided from each other by the whole width of the house, as far apart as their own lives had become. Involuntarily she sighed. At that moment she could really not have told why. She was suffering from unconquerable heartache. Deeply and achingly she was sorry for herself. Never had she felt so pitiably lonely, so bitterly in want of comfort and of sympathy. With another sigh she turned away from the river towards the house, vaguely wondering if, after such a night, she could ever find rest and sleep. Suddenly, before she reached the terrace, she heard a firm step upon the crisp gravel, and the next moment her husband's figure emerged out of the shadow. He, too, had skirted the house, and was wandering along the lawn towards the river. He still wore his heavy driving coat with the numerous lapels and collars he himself had set in fashion, but he had thrown it well back, burying his hands, as was his wont, in the deep pockets of his satin breeches. The gorgeous white costume he had worn at Lord Grenville's ball, with its jabot of priceless lace, looked strangely ghostly against the dark background of the house. He apparently did not notice her, for, after a few moments' pause, he presently turned back towards the house and walked straight up to the terrace.
"Sir Percy."
He already had one foot on the lowest of the terrace steps, but at her voice he started and paused, then looked searchingly into the shadows whence she had called to him. She came forward quickly into the moonlight, and as soon as he saw her, he said with that air of consummate gallantry he always wore when speaking to her, "At your service, madame." But his foot was still on the step, and in his whole attitude there was a remote suggestion, distinctly visible to her, that he wished to go, and had no desire for a midnight interview.
"The air is deliciously cool," she said, "the moonlight peaceful and poetic, and the garden inviting. Will you not stay in it a while? The hour is not yet late, or is my company so distasteful to you that you are in a hurry to rid yourself of it?"
"Nay, madame," he rejoined placidly, "but 'tis on the other foot the shoe happens to be, and I'll warrant you'll find the midnight air more poetic without my company. No doubt the sooner I remove the obstruction, the better your ladyship will like it." He turned once more to go.
"I protest you mistake me, Sir Percy," she said hurriedly, and drawing a little closer to him. "The estrangement, which, alas, has arisen between us, was none of my making, remember?"
"Oh, begad, you must pardon me there, madame," he protested coldly. "My memory was always of the shortest." He looked her straight in the eyes with that lazy nonchalance which had become second nature to him. She returned his gaze for a moment, then her eyes softened as she came up quite close to him, to the foot of the terrace steps.
"Of the shortest, Sir Percy? Faith, how it must have altered! Was it 3 years ago or four that you saw me for 1 hour in Paris on your way to the East? When you came back 2 years later, you had not forgotten me?"
She looked divinely pretty as she stood there in the moonlight, with the fur cloak sliding off her beautiful shoulders, the gold embroidery on her dress shimmering around her, her childlike blue eyes turned up fully at him. He stood for a moment, rigid and still, but for the clenching of his hand against the stone balustrade of the terrace. "You desired my presence, madame," he said frigidly. "I take it that it was not with a view to indulging in tender reminiscences." His voice certainly was cold and uncompromising, his attitude before her stiff and unbending. Womanly decorum would have suggested that Marguerite should return coldness for coldness, and should sweep past him without another word, only with a curt nod of the head. But womanly instinct suggested that she should remain, that keen instinct which makes a beautiful woman conscious of her powers long to bring to her knees the one man who pays her no homage. She stretched out her hand to him.
"Nay, Sir Percy, why not? The present is not so glorious but that I should not wish to dwell a little in the past."
He bent his tall figure, and taking hold of the extreme tip of the fingers which she still held out to him, he kissed them ceremoniously. "I' faith, madame," he said, "then you will pardon me if my dull wits cannot accompany you there." Once again he attempted to go. Once more her voice, sweet, childlike, almost tender, called him back.
"Sir Percy?"
"Your servant, madame."
"Is it possible that love can die?" she said with sudden, unreasoning vehemence.
"Methought that the passion which you once felt for me would outlast the span of human life. Is there nothing left of that love, Percy, which might help you to bridge over that sad estrangement?"
His massive figure seemed, while she spoke thus to him, to stiffen still more. The strong mouth hardened. A look of relentless obstinacy crept into the habitually lazy blue eyes. "With what object, I pray you, madame?" he asked coldly.
"I do not understand you."
"Yet 'tis simple enough," he said with sudden bitterness, which seemed literally to surge through his words, though he was making visible efforts to suppress it. "I humbly put the question to you, for my slow wits are unable to grasp the cause of this, your ladyship's sudden new mood. Is it that you have the taste to renew the devilish sport which you played so successfully last year? Do you wish to see me once more a lovesick suppliant at your feet, so that you might again have the pleasure of kicking me aside like a troublesome lap-dog?" She had succeeded in rousing him for the moment, and again she looked straight at him, for it was thus she remembered him a year ago.
"Percy, I entreat you," she whispered, "can we not bury the past?"
"Oh, pardon me, madame, but I understood you to say that your desire was to dwell in it."
"Nay, I spoke not of that past, Percy," she said, while a tone of tenderness crept into her voice. "Rather did I speak of the time when you loved me still. And I was vain and frivolous. Your wealth and position allured me. I married you, hoping in my heart that your great love for me would beget in me a love for you. But alas!"
The moon had sunk low down behind a bank of clouds. In the east, a soft grey light was beginning to chase away the heavy mantle of the night. He could only see her graceful outline now, the small queenly head with its wealth of reddish-golden curls, and the glittering gems forming the small star-shaped red flower which she wore as a diadem in her hair.
24 hours after our marriage, madame, the Marquis de Saint-Cyr and all his family perished on the guillotine, and the popular rumour reached me that it was the wife of Sir Percy Blakeney who helped to send them there.
Nay, I myself told you the truth of that odious tale.
Not till after it had been recounted to me by strangers, with all its horrible details.
And you believed them then and there, she said with great vehemence, without a proof or question. You believed that I, whom you vowed you loved more than life, whom you professed you worshipped, that I could do a thing so base as these strangers chose to recount. You thought I meant to deceive you about it all, that I ought to have spoken before I married you. Yet had you listened, I would have told you that up to the very morning on which Saint-Cyr went to the guillotine, I was straining every nerve, using every influence I possessed to save him and his family. But my pride sealed my lips when your love seemed to perish as if under the knife of that same guillotine. Yet I would have told you how I was duped. I, whom that same popular rumour had endowed with the sharpest wits in France, I was tricked into doing this thing by men who knew how to play upon my love for an only brother and my desire for revenge. Was it unnatural?
Her voice became choked with tears. She paused for a moment or two, trying to regain some sort of composure. She looked appealingly at him, almost as if he were her judge. He had allowed her to speak on in her own vehement, impassioned way, offering no comment, no word of sympathy. And now, while she paused, trying to swallow down the hot tears that gushed to her eyes, he waited, impassive and still. The dim grey light of early dawn seemed to make his tall form look taller and more rigid. The lazy, good-natured face looked strangely altered. Marguerite, excited as she was, could see that the eyes were no longer languid, the mouth no longer good-humoured and inane. A curious look of intense passion seemed to glow from beneath his drooping lids. The mouth was tightly closed, the lips compressed, as if the will alone held that surging passion in check. Marguerite Blakeney was, above all, a woman with all a woman's fascinating foibles, all a woman's most lovable sins. She knew in a moment that for the past few months she had been mistaken, that this man who stood here before her, cold as a statue, when her musical voice struck upon his ear, loved her, as he had loved her a year ago, that his passion might have been dormant, but that it was there, as strong, as intense, as overwhelming as when first her lips met his in one long, maddening kiss. Pride had kept him from her. And, womanlike, she meant to win back that conquest which had been hers before. Suddenly it seemed to her that the only happiness life could ever hold for her again would be in feeling that man's kiss once more upon her lips.
"Listen to the tale, Sir Percy," she said, and her voice now was low, sweet, infinitely tender. "Armand was all in all to me. We had no parents, and brought one another up. He was my little father, and I his tiny mother. We loved one another so. Then one day, do you mind me, Sir Percy, the Marquis de Saint-Cyr had my brother Armand thrashed by his lackeys, that brother whom I loved better than all the world. And his offence, that he, a plebeian, had dared to love the daughter of the aristocrat. For that he was waylaid and thrashed like a dog within an inch of his life. Oh, how I suffered! His humiliation had eaten into my very soul. When the opportunity occurred and I was able to take my revenge, I took it. But I only thought to bring that proud Marquis to trouble and humiliation. He plotted with Austria against his own country.
Chance gave me knowledge of this.
I spoke of it, but I did not know. How could I guess? They trapped and duped me. When I realized what I had done, it was too late.
"It is perhaps a little difficult, madame," said Sir Percy after a moment of silence between them, "to go back over the past. I have confessed to you that my memory is short, but the thought certainly lingered in my mind that, at the time of the Marquis's death, I entreated you for an explanation of those same noisome popular rumours. If that same memory does not, even now, play me a trick, I fancy that you refused me all explanation then, and demanded of my love a humiliating allegiance it was not prepared to give."
I wished to test your love for me, and it did not bear the test. You used to tell me that you drew the very breath of life but for me, and for love of me.
And to probe that love, you demanded that I should forfeit mine honour, he said, whilst gradually his impassiveness seemed to leave him, his rigidity to relax. That I should accept without murmur or question, as a dumb and submissive slave, every action of my mistress. My heart overflowing with love and passion, I asked for no explanation. I waited for one, not doubting, only hoping. Had you spoken but one word, from you I would have accepted any explanation and believed it. But you left me without a word, beyond a bald confession of the actual horrible facts. Proudly you returned to your brother's house and left me alone, for weeks, not knowing, now, in whom to believe, since the shrine which contained my one illusion lay shattered to earth at my feet. She need not complain now that he was cold and impassive. His very voice shook with an intensity of passion which he was making superhuman efforts to keep in check.
"Aye, the madness of my pride," she said sadly. "Hardly had I gone, already I had repented. But when I returned I found you, oh, so altered, wearing already that mask of somnolent indifference which you have never laid aside until now."
She was so close to him that her soft, loose hair was wafted against his cheek. Her eyes, glowing with tears, maddened him. The music in her voice sent fire through his veins. But he would not yield to the magic charm of this woman whom he had so deeply loved, and at whose hands his pride had suffered so bitterly. He closed his eyes to shut out the dainty vision of that sweet face, of that snow-white neck and graceful figure, round which the faint rosy light of dawn was just beginning to hover playfully.
"Nay, madame, it is no mask," he said icily. "I swore to you, once, that my life was yours. For months now it has been your plaything. It has served its purpose."
But now she knew that that very coldness was a mask. The trouble, the sorrow she had gone through last night suddenly came back to her mind, but no longer with bitterness, rather with a feeling that this man, who loved her, would help her to bear the burden.
"Sir Percy," she said impulsively, "heaven knows you have been at pains to make the task which I had set to myself terribly difficult to accomplish. You spoke of my mood just now. Well, we will call it that, if you will. I wish to speak to you because I was in trouble, and had need of your sympathy."
"It is yours to command, madame."
"How cold you are," she sighed. "Faith, I can scarce believe that but a few months ago one tear in my eye had set you well nigh crazy. Now I come to you with a half-broken heart, and—"
"I pray you, madame," he said, whilst his voice shook almost as much as hers, "in what way can I serve you?"
"Percy, Armand is in deadly danger. A letter of his, rash, impetuous, as were all his actions, and written to Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, has fallen into the hands of a fanatic. Armand is hopelessly compromised. Tomorrow, perhaps, he will be arrested. After that, the guillotine, unless—oh, it is horrible," she said with a sudden wail of anguish, as all the events of the past night came rushing back to her mind. "Horrible. And you do not understand. You cannot, and I have no one to whom I can turn for help or even for sympathy."
Tears now refused to be held back. All her trouble, her struggles, the awful uncertainty of Armand's fate overwhelmed her. She tottered, ready to fall, and leaning against the stone balustrade, she buried her face in her hands and sobbed bitterly. At first mention of Armand Saint-Just's name and of the peril in which he stood, Sir Percy's face had become a shade more pale, and the look of determination and obstinacy appeared more marked than ever between his eyes. However, he said nothing for the moment, but watched her as her delicate frame was shaken with sobs, watched her until unconsciously his face softened, and what looked almost like tears seemed to glisten in his eyes. "And so," he said with bitter sarcasm, "the murderous dog of the revolution is turning upon the very hands that fed it. Begad, madame," he added very gently, as Marguerite continued to sob hysterically, "will you dry your tears? I never could bear to see a pretty woman cry, and I—" Instinctively, with sudden overmastering passion at sight of her helplessness and of her grief, he stretched out his arms, and the next would have seized her and held her to him, protected from every evil with his very life, his very heart's blood. But pride had the better of it in this struggle once again. He restrained himself with a tremendous effort of will and said coldly, though still very gently, "Will you not turn to me, madame, and tell me in what way I may have the honour to serve you?" She made a violent effort to control herself, and turning her tear-stained face to him, she once more held out her hand, which he kissed with the same punctilious gallantry. But Marguerite's fingers, this time, lingered in his hand for a second or two longer than was absolutely necessary, and this was because she had felt that his hand trembled perceptibly and was burning hot, whilst his lips felt as cold as marble.
"Can you do aught for Armand?" she said sweetly and simply. "You have so much influence at court, so many friends."
"Oh, nay, madame, should you not rather seek the influence of your French friend, Monsieur Chauvelin? His extends, if I mistake not, even as far as the republican government of France."
"I cannot ask him, Percy. Oh, I wish I dared to tell you, but he has put a price on my brother's head which—"
She would have given worlds if she had felt the courage then to tell him everything, all she had done that night, how she had suffered, and how her hand had been forced. But she dared not give way to that impulse, not now, when she was just beginning to feel that he still loved her, when she hoped that she could win him back. She dared not make another confession to him. After all, he might not understand. He might not sympathize with her struggles and temptation. His love, still dormant, might sleep the sleep of death. Perhaps he divined what was passing in her mind. His whole attitude was one of intense longing, a veritable prayer for that confidence which her foolish pride withheld from him. When she remained silent, he sighed, and said with marked coldness, "Faith, madame, since it distresses you, we will not speak of it. As for Armand, I pray you have no fear. I pledge you my word that he shall be safe. Now have I your permission to go? The hour is getting late, and—"
"You will at least accept my gratitude," she said,
as she drew quite close to him and speaking with real tenderness. With a quick, almost involuntary effort, he would have taken her then in his arms, for her eyes were swimming in tears, which he longed to kiss away. But she had lured him once, just like this, then cast him aside like an ill-fitting glove. He thought this was but a mood, a caprice, and he was too proud to lend himself to it once again. "It is too soon, madame," he said quietly. "I have done nothing as yet. The hour is late, and you must be fatigued. Your women will be waiting for you upstairs." He stood aside to allow her to pass. She sighed, a quick sigh of disappointment. His pride and her beauty had been in direct conflict, and his pride had remained the conqueror. Perhaps, after all, she had been deceived just now. What she took to be the light of love in his eyes might only have been the passion of pride, or, who knows, of hatred instead of love. She stood looking at him for a moment or two longer. He was again as rigid, as impassive as before. Pride had conquered, and he cared naught for her. The grey of dawn was gradually yielding to the rosy light of the rising sun. Birds began to twitter. Nature awakened, smiling in happy response to the warmth of this glorious October morning. Only between these two hearts there lay a strong, impassable barrier, built up of pride on both sides, which neither of them cared to be the first to demolish. He had bent his tall figure in a low, ceremonious bow, as she finally, with another bitter little sigh, began to mount the terrace steps. The long train of her gold-embroidered gown swept the dead leaves off the steps, making a faint, harmonious shh, 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 as she glided up, with one hand resting on the balustrade, the rosy light of dawn making an aureole of gold round her hair, and causing the rubies on her head and arms to sparkle. She reached the tall glass doors which led into the house. Before entering, she paused once again to look at him, hoping against hope to see his arms stretched out to her, and to hear his voice calling her back. But he had not moved. His massive figure looked the very personification of unbending pride, of fierce obstinacy. Hot tears again surged to her eyes, and as she would not let him see them, she turned quickly within and ran as fast as she could up to her own rooms. Had she but turned back then and looked out once more onto the rose-lit garden, she would have seen that which would have made her own suffering seem but light and easy to bear. A strong man, overwhelmed with his own passion and his own despair. Pride had given way at last, obstinacy was gone, the will was powerless. He was but a man, madly, blindly, passionately in love, and as soon as her light footstep had died away within the house, he knelt down upon the terrace steps, and in the very madness of his love, he kissed, one by one, the places where her small foot had trodden, and the stone balustrade there where her tiny hand had rested last. Chapter 17. Farewell. When Marguerite reached her room, she found her maid terribly anxious about her.
"Your ladyship will be so tired," said the poor woman, whose own eyes were half closed with sleep. "It's past 5 o'clock."
"Ah, yes, Louise, I dare say I shall be tired presently," said Marguerite kindly. "But you are very tired now, so go to bed at once. I'll get into bed alone."
"But my lady—"
"No, don't argue, Louise, but go to bed. Give me a wrap and leave me alone."
Louise was only too glad to obey. She took off her mistress's gorgeous ball dress and wrapped her up in a soft, billowy gown.
"Does your ladyship wish for anything else?"
she asked, when that was done.
"No, nothing more. Put out the lights as you go out."
"Yes, my lady."
"Good night, my lady."
"Good night, Louise."
When the maid was gone, Marguerite drew aside the curtains and threw open the windows. The garden and the river beyond were flooded with rosy light. Far away to the east, the rays of the rising sun had changed the rose into vivid gold. The lawn was deserted now, and Marguerite looked down upon the terrace where she had stood a few moments ago, trying vainly to win back a man's love, which once had been so wholly hers. It was strange that through all her troubles, all her anxiety for Armand, she was mostly conscious at the present moment of a keen and bitter heartache. Her very limbs seemed to ache with longing for the love of a man who had spurned her, who had resisted her tenderness, remained cold to her appeals, and had not responded to the glow of passion which had caused her to feel and hope that those happy olden days in Paris were not all dead and forgotten. How strange it all was! She loved him still. And now that she looked back upon the last few months of misunderstandings and of loneliness, she realized that she had never ceased to love him, that deep down in her heart she had always vaguely felt that his foolish inanities, his empty laugh, his lazy nonchalance were nothing but a mask, that the real man, strong, passionate, willful, was there still, the man she had loved, whose intensity had fascinated her, whose personality attracted her, since she always felt that behind his apparently slow wits there was a certain something which he kept hidden from all the world, and most especially from her. A woman's heart is such a complex problem. The owner thereof is often most incompetent to find the solution of this puzzle. Did Marguerite Blakeney, the cleverest woman in Europe, really love a fool? Was it love that she had felt for him a year ago when she married him? Was it love she felt for him now that she realized that he still loved her, but that he would not become her slave, her passionate, ardent lover once again? Nay, Marguerite herself could not have told that. Not at this moment, at any rate. Her pride had sealed her mind against a better understanding of her own heart. But this she did know, that she meant to capture that obstinate heart back again, that she would conquer once more, and then that she would never lose him. She would keep him, keep his love, deserve it, and cherish it. For this much was certain, that there was no longer any happiness possible for her without that one man's love. Thus the most contradictory thoughts and emotions rushed madly through her mind. Absorbed in them, she had allowed time to slip by. Perhaps, tired out with long excitement, she had actually closed her eyes and sank into a troubled sleep, wherein quickly fleeting dreams seemed but the continuation of her anxious thoughts, when suddenly she was roused, from dream or meditation, by the noise of footsteps outside her door. Nervously she jumped up and listened. The house itself was as still as ever. The footsteps had retreated. Through her wide-open windows, the brilliant rays of the morning sun were flooding her own room with light. She looked up at the clock. It was 6:30, too early for any of the household to be already astir. She certainly must have dropped asleep, quite unconsciously. The noise of the footsteps, also of hushed, subdued voices, had awakened her. What could they be? Gently, on tiptoe, she crossed the room and opened the door to listen. Not a sound. That peculiar stillness of the early morning when sleep with all mankind is at its heaviest. But the noise had made her nervous, and when, suddenly, at her feet, on the very doorstep, she saw something white lying there, a letter, evidently, she hardly dared touch it. It seemed so ghost-like. It certainly was not there when she came upstairs. Had Louise dropped it? Or was some tantalizing spook at play, showing her fairy letters where none existed? At last she stooped to pick it up, and, amazed, puzzled beyond measure, she saw that the letter was addressed to herself in her husband's large, business-looking hand. What could he have to say to her in the middle of the night which could not be put off until the morning? She tore open the envelope and read, "A most unforeseen circumstance forces me to leave for the North immediately, so I beg your ladyship's pardon if I do not avail myself of the honour of bidding you good-bye. My business may keep me employed for about a week, so I shall not have the privilege of being present at your ladyship's water-party on Wednesday. I remain your ladyship's most humble and most obedient servant, Percy Blakeney." Marguerite must suddenly have been imbued with her husband's slowness of intellect, for she had perforce to read the few simple lines over and over again before she could fully grasp their meaning. She stood on the landing, turning over and over in her hand this curt and mysterious epistle, her mind a blank, her nerves strained with agitation and a presentiment she could not very well have explained. Sir Percy owned considerable property in the North, certainly, and he had often before gone there alone and stayed away a week at a time. But it seemed so very strange that circumstances should have arisen between 5 and 6 o'clock in the morning that compelled him to start in this extreme hurry. Vainly she tried to shake off an unaccustomed feeling of nervousness. She was trembling from head to foot. A wild, unconquerable desire seized her to see her husband again, at once, if only he had not already started. Forgetting the fact that she was only very lightly clad in a morning wrap, and that her hair lay loosely about her shoulders, she flew down the stairs, right through the hall towards the front door. It was, as usual, barred and bolted, for the indoor servants were not yet up. But her keen ears had detected the sound of voices and the pawing of a horse's hoof against the flagstones. With nervous, trembling fingers, Marguerite undid the bolts one by one, bruising her hands, hurting her nails, for the locks were heavy and stiff. But she did not care. Her whole frame shook with anxiety at the very thought that she might be too late, that he might have gone without her seeing him and bidding him Godspeed. At last she had turned the key and thrown open the door. Her ears had not deceived her. A groom was standing close by holding a couple of horses. One of these was Sultan, Sir Percy's favourite and swiftest horse, saddled ready for a journey. The next moment Sir Percy himself appeared round the further corner of the house and came quickly towards the horses. He had changed his gorgeous ball costume, but was as usual irreproachably and richly apparelled in a suit of fine cloth, with lace jabot and ruffles, high top boots and riding breeches. Marguerite went forward a few steps. He looked up and saw her. A slight frown appeared between his eyes.
"You are going?" she said quickly and feverishly. "Whither?"
"As I have had the honour of informing your ladyship, urgent, most unexpected business calls me to the North this morning," he said in his usual cold, drawly manner.
"But your guests tomorrow?"
"I have prayed your ladyship to offer my humble excuses to His Royal Highness. You are such a perfect hostess, I do not think that I shall be missed."
"But surely you might have waited for your journey until after our water-party," she said, still speaking quickly and nervously. "Surely the business is not so urgent. And you said nothing about it just now."
"My business, as I had the honour to tell you, madame, is as unexpected as it is urgent. May I therefore crave your permission to go? Can I do aught for you in town, on my way back?"
No, thanks, nothing. But you will be back soon?"
"Very soon."
"Before the end of the week?"
"I cannot say." He was evidently trying to get away, whilst she was straining every nerve to keep him back for a moment or two.
"Percy," she said, "will you not tell me why you go today? Surely I, as your wife, have the right to know. You have not been called away to the North, I know it. There were no letters, no couriers from there before we left for the opera last night, and nothing was waiting for you when we returned from the ball. You are not going to the North, I feel convinced. There is some mystery, and—"
"Nay, there is no mystery, madame," he replied with a slight tone of impatience. My business has to do with Armand. There. Now, have I your leave to depart?
With Armand? But you will run no danger.
Danger? I? Nay, madame, your solicitude does me honour. As you say, I have some influence. My intention is to exert it before it be too late.
Will you allow me to thank you at least?
Nay, madame, he said coldly, there is no need for that. My life is at your service, and I am already more than repaid.
And mine will be at yours, Sir Percy, if you will but accept it, in exchange for what you do for Armand, she said as impulsively she stretched out both her hands to him. There, I will not detain you. My thoughts go with you. Farewell.
How lovely she looked in this morning sunlight, with her ardent hair streaming around her shoulders. He bowed very low and kissed her hand. She felt the burning kiss, and her heart thrilled with joy and hope.
You will come back, she said tenderly.
Very soon, he replied, looking longingly into her blue eyes.
And you will remember?
She asked, as her eyes, in response to his look, gave him an infinity of promise. I will always remember, madame, that you have honoured me by commanding my services. The words were cold and formal, but they did not chill her this time. Her woman's heart had read his beneath the impassive mask his pride still forced him to wear. He bowed to her again, then begged her leave to depart. She stood on one side whilst he jumped onto Sultan's back, then, as he galloped out of the gates, she waved him a final adieu. A bend in the road soon hid him from view. His confidential groom had some difficulty in keeping pace with him, for Sultan flew along in response to his master's excited mood. Marguerite, with a sigh that was almost a happy one, turned and went within. She went back to her room, for suddenly, like a tired child, she felt quite sleepy. Her heart seemed all at once to be in complete peace, and though it still ached with undefined longing, a vague and delicious hope soothed it as with a balm. She felt no longer anxious about Armand. The man who had just ridden away, bent on helping her brother, inspired her with complete confidence in his strength and in his power. She marvelled at herself for having ever looked upon him as an inane fool. Of course, that was a mask worn to hide the bitter wound she had dealt to his faith and to his love. His passion would have overmastered him, and he would not let her see how much he still cared and how deeply he suffered. But now all would be well. She would crush her own pride, humble it before him, tell him everything, trust him in everything. And those happy days would come back when they used to wander off together in the forests of Fontainebleau, when they spoke little, for he was always a silent man. But when she felt that against that strong heart she would always find rest and happiness. The more she thought of the events of the past night, the less fear she had of Chauvelin and his schemes. He had failed to discover the identity of the Scarlet Pimpernel, of that she felt sure. Both Lord Fancourt and Chauvelin himself had assured her that no one had been in the dining-room at 1 o'clock, except the Frenchman himself and Percy. Yes, Percy. She might have asked him, had she thought of it. Anyway, she had no fears that the unknown and brave hero would fall in Chauvelin's trap. His death, at any rate, would not be at her door. Armand certainly was still in danger, but Percy had pledged his word that Armand would be safe, and somehow, as Marguerite had seen him riding away, the possibility that he could fail in whatever he undertook never even remotely crossed her mind. When Armand was safely over in England, she would not allow him to go back to France. She felt almost happy now, and, drawing the curtains closely together again to shut out the piercing sun, she went to bed at last, laid her head upon the pillow, and, like a wearied child, soon fell into a peaceful and dreamless sleep.